Hi, everyone. It's Tom Power. I'm back with a brand new and very special episode of Toy Heart, my podcast about bluegrass. It is an exclusive conversation with none other than Billy Strings that we recorded at last year's International Bluegrass Music Association Conference. If you love bluegrass as much as we do, and I assume you do, then this episode is certainly for you. Download and listen to this and all episodes of Toy Heart on the BGS Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. It is me, Cindy Howes, and I host this podcast. Thanks for being here. Okay, so today, a real dream for me personally. Rachel McCartney has not released music in almost 20 years. I have been waiting. I met Rachel in the early 2000s when I was in college. She was my favorite singer. I would go see her perform all the time. She played a special concert on my 21st birthday at Toad in Porter Square in Cambridge. She means a lot to me, and I'm so happy that she's here. Before we get into that, let's talk about ways that we can stay in touch. You can sign up for Basic Folks newsletter, which is a once-a-month email that tells you who's been on the podcast and who's coming up. You can sign up for that at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. and sign up there. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok. We're also a listener-supported podcast. You can make a contribution by going to basicfolk.com/donate, and there is also a link in the show notes. All right. For 17 years, Rachel McCartney had set aside a music career and all of the anxiety and uncertainty that came along with it. She was in her mid-30s and wanted a family and some stability. Once she started a new life as an ICU nurse and mother to two young children, her musical career and the momentum she had created over the past three decades in New England and Western Pennsylvania didn't much cross her mind. I met Rachel when I was 18 years old while at Emerson College. It was the year 2000, and the folk scene in Boston was poppin' with incredible talent. Lori McKenna, Deb Talon, Anais Mitchell, and many others were selling out shows left and right in listening rooms across New England. Rachel was a frequent name that popped up in the newspaper, on radio, as a busker in the subway, and around town at venues like the Kendall Cafe, Toad, and of course, the folk mothership, Club Passim. It was a lucrative time for the singer-songwriter with a big voice and great songs. She would frequently appear with another Boston-famous yet under-the-radar songwriter, the Atlanta-born Brian Webb. If you were at Rachel's recent album release, you were treated to some Rachel and Brian classics that lit up the WERS coffeehouse in the early 2000s. Needless to say, I am so thrilled that Rachel's released new music, and I'm very excited that she agreed to be on the podcast today. In our conversation, we discuss her move from Iowa to Massachusetts as a teen and how the impact of that has influenced the way she makes decisions for her kids. She talks about her relationship to the guitar, her singing, and her songwriting. She addresses the allegations that indeed she is a horse girl through and through. She moved to Pittsburgh in her 20s on a whim, which is something we have in common. She reflects on Pittsburgh, busking in Boston, and what it was like to choose a stable life with a family and nursing. Her new album, Taming Dragons, was produced by Zach Hickman, and she shares what it felt like to be in the studio after nearly two decades. I was pleased to point out that Dragons also appear on Tori Amos's new album, In the Time of Dragons, which then led Rachel to share what the dragon symbolizes for her. We did this interview in my backyard, much like Oprah, and you can hear birds, lawnmowers, and you can also hear Francie in the background, but I think it all adds to the atmosphere. I have interviewed Rachel many, many times, but it was all before my cerebral cortex was fully formed, so this is basically the first real interview I have done with the fabulous Rachel McCartney. We'll take a listen to a song from her new album, In the Shape That I Am, and then we'll get to our conversation with Rachel McCartney on Basic Folk.
You can stay if you want to, darling. We can make that a plan. with a heart of a gypsy and a sword that can bleed. All I need is a sturdy vessel with dragons for my company. In the shape of a woman trying for the time in her life. Warriors in the form of princesses in the shape of a wife.
I'm so excited to talk to you, Rachel. So glad you could be here in my backyard with me.
Yeah, it's really cool.
I also feel like, I was telling my wife, I was like, I've interviewed Rachel like 75 times, but this is like the first interview. I feel like this is like our first real interview because I didn't know how to interview people back in the day.
Right.
So I'm just so excited.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I can, and also... I believe we really didn't have much one-on-one.
Right.
It was...
A lot of group hangs.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
So, all right, here we go. All right, we're going to start at the beginning.
Okay.
You were born in a small town in Iowa, right?
I was actually born in Oak Park, Illinois, which is just right across the street from Chicago.
Oh.
Yeah. And so I lived there for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to a small town in Iowa, which I consider held my formative years.
Mm-hmm.
So from about 2 until about 12, 11 or 12. Being born, I essentially was born mm-hmm. in Iowa. That's where I became kind of conscious.
Yeah. Okay.
As a human being.
So how do you think that time in Iowa continues to impact who you are?
You know, that's such a good question because I think for everybody, I think this is universal truth that, you know, where we spend our formative years, it really does shape our kind of core worldview and essence of how we go about and walk through our life, right? When anybody asks me where I'm from, I think Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a very unassuming childhood, little farm, you know, hardly a farm, just a bunch of trees that my dad planted in the middle of a cornfield. My parents were pretty industrious. I was industrious. I wanted a pony. We grabbed a pony from a farmer in the next town, mm-hmm. brought her home. I was self-taught with horse care, and I didn't know anything, and I got a lot wrong. But I worked. You know, I babysat for horse money, and I did chores, and I was just an industrious kid. And so I think that way of being has just been part of how I go about, you know, whatever I'm passionate about doing.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's cool. So you and your family moved to Massachusetts when you were how old?
I was going into sixth grade, which was just...
What a great time.
Awful.
For a young lady.
A very, you know... unassuming little skinny kid. I wore Wrangler jeans and like t-shirts like this. You know, I had no kind of style. Long blonde hair. I was, cute as a button, but it was not anything. I wasn't ready for the sixth grade mentality of like the East Coast fisherman girls, you know.
You're in North Shore, Massachusetts.
North Shore, yeah. Essex, Massachusetts. So this little fishing village with these precocious sixth grade, you know, middle school girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like completely out of... like a fish out of water. I didn't know anything about how to be cool or, you know, makeup or whatever.
So it's hard enough, I think, to be 11 or 12 years old.
Yeah.
And then having that huge move must have been so hard. How do you think about yourself at that age, going through that move through the lens of, like, now that you're a mom?
Yeah. So, a lot of the decisions I've made for my kids are informed by that experience. So, you know, I want to move somewhere where the winters aren't as intense. But my
I feel
kids,
like that's been a dream of yours for a long time.
Yeah. But my kids have been ensconced in a system that's been really good for them, and they have a home and they've grown up there. And I'm not gonna do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's important for them to feel locked in where they are. And now, especially, they're in high school. So we've got just a couple more years of my oldest is going to graduate this year, and my youngest is going to be a sophomore. So we're pretty close to in the home stretch. But I think, you know, there's big sweeping transitions that I would never ask or impose upon them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not upset at my parents for having made that transition. I'm actually kind of grateful because, a lot of opportunities opened up for me, obviously, mm-hmm. on the, mm-hmm. you know, the East Coast, a little more progressive. And I think I would have been pretty stifled mm-hmm. in the small town Midwest. But just as far as the emotional impact,
sure.
I think I've probably been a little more careful. Mm. And the timing, like if you're going to move, do it when your baby is two.
Right.
Yeah.
So you started writing songs, like, really seriously in your 20s. You were writing songs when you were little, like a little kid, but seriously started writing in your 20s. How has the feeling of writing a song changed for you over the years, and how has the function of songwriting evolved?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I'll start with the feeling first. I think in my 20s, I was very serious about, you know, putting forth an idea with music. I think a lot of those songs came from a really pure emotional place that I hadn't processed fully. And maybe we never do process them fully. Maybe that's the stage. You know, first it's the emotional kind of landscape that comes out and the song is created. But I do feel like it was much more of a direct kind of emotional outpouring onto the page. And that served a purpose, right? And I think probably I may have been a little bit more free with the songwriting. Now I'm a little more analytical about it, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. I just think maybe I'm better at combining that emotional response to whatever with a sort of logical progression or... you know, maybe more of a storyline. But I think my songs are, you know, pretty, I think of them sometimes as, you know, watercolors or water painting. You know, sometimes the landscape isn't really that clear. You know, sometimes it's just like blobs on a page that kind of look cool together.
That's cool. I read you started on classical guitar when you were 8.
Yeah.
What has been your relationship to the guitar throughout your life?
Yeah, interesting. So when I started playing classical guitar, I was inspired at a concert, I believe, at my dad's college. And I'm not even sure my parents, you know, jumped on that. And I got this classical nylon string guitar. I started playing lessons in, we lived in Atlanta for a year in, when I was in fourth grade. My dad took a sabbatical. So in Atlanta, I started classical guitar lessons. And then when we went back to Iowa, I was going into fifth grade then.
What did your dad do for work?
He's a professor.
Oh, okay.
Of American literature. And ooh, an English professor.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And a writer and all that.
You must have had some serious books in your house growing up.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I'm not much of a reader, so.
inherit that.
I do love a good book, you know, and a novel and some of the classics, but it's just not, I think sometimes when your parents are really into something, you're just kind of like, all right, that's wicked boring.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's a grown-up thing. And so I continued with the classical guitar from when I was 8 until, you know, about 15, 16. I would have, when we moved to Essex, I continued that. I had a Japanese guitar player, and he came over and I learned the Suzuki method, which is primarily by ear. I didn't understand a word he said ever.
Mm-hmm.
So my lessons were, I could read the notes. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand much about theory. It's kind of strange, but I could read, and I can still read to this day, a classical piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started the songwriting, and then it was like classical wasn't cool, you know?
Mm.
But in the meantime, I gained, you know, some dexterity, and my finger picking is directly a result from that.
Yeah, that's
training.
So cool.
Yeah.
All right, now let's talk about your singing. Here's a quote from Ellis Paul. We all know Ellis Paul.
We all know Ellis.
Rachel's voice may be one of the most perfect manifestations of heaven any of us are ever likely to experience in this humble earthly domain. What a quote.
Wow.
Wow. You have cited singing influences like Stevie Nicks, Bonnie Raitt, Bessie Smith, Ella Fitzgerald as early influences and vocal teachers.
Hmm.
So I also have read that advice that you would give to somebody who wanted to start music is like learn the craft, but then put yourself into that craft.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about emulating those vocalists and then like mixing in your own style into that delivery?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think, you know, there's something that happens with the ear. So, right, I think I've always had a really astute ear, and I can kind of sound like somebody. You know what I mean? I can learn something really quick. I can learn.
Are you good at like impressions?
I think I am.
Yeah.
I think I am. Yeah. I'll come out with a voice. I'll just kind of randomly, as long as I don't think about it too much, but there are a couple that I've practiced, I think, you know, party trick or whatever.
Yeah.
So I don't think I've thought about, putting my own spin on my voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I do, once in a while, I can hear like the influence mm-hmm. of whoever. I think because I sang a lot of those songs when I was 16, 17, till I was about 20, I was in a rock and roll cover band, and we covered a lot of those artists. So I would be learning the songs and then singing them with the band, not trying to sound like them, but it's inevitable,
mm-hmm.
right, that I would kind of pick up some of those nuances and hopefully make them my own.
Mm-hmm.
Although I never really, I think I was sensitive to sounding too much like somebody, and I would always get comparisons. Which is fine, but I think getting comparisons would drive me further into finding my own voice, my own sound.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Is the rock band you were talking about the Walker Creek band?
Yes. So you've heard about them.
Can you tell the famous story of you sneaking out of the house to sing with this dad band?
This dad band, totally, guys. I mean, when I think back to how crazy and how I would never, my kids, first of all, would never be able to sneak out of the house at 16. I don't even know. I just walked out the front door, you know, and how would I get down there? I suppose I'd ride my bike. I mean, I was 16. I didn't drive. Maybe I was driving. So it was just about maybe half a mile down the road. All of the guys in the band were friends of my dad's neighbors. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what they were thinking. Like, it was just normal. Like, I showed up and I would practice these songs and then I'd go. Like, this was their bro time.
Yeah.
So I came into the bro time. The bro time was like probably 3 hours on Friday nights. Mm-hmm. And I was there for maybe like 45 minutes or an hour. Mm-hmm. Doing the girl songs or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And then I would meet them at gigs and play the chick songs and sing some backup. But yeah, it's just wild. And my parents did know about it. Like, nobody was keeping the secret.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because I've never really talked to my parents about what was going through their heads. I think I'm going to because...
Well, let's call them right now.
Let's call them right now.
Yes, let's get them on the line.
And I don't know why I've never even talked to them about it. I think, honestly, at this point, they would be like kind of clueless.
Yeah.
They were kind of in their own world dealing with stuff. And so in a lot of ways, I was kind of a feral child.
So in your mid-20s, you started busking or playing on the streets of Cambridge and in the subway quite a bit, which is a huge deal for Boston in the 80s, 90s, in the O's.
Yeah, the O's.
This was a time where you could make a living at something like this. Like,
oh, yeah.
What would an average day look like for you at that time when you were busking?
I would very early. I'm an early riser, always have been. And so that worked out pretty great. I liked the morning rush in the T station. I would play Davis a lot. I'd get up at 5, haul my equipment down there. I had a dog with me and we'd sit on the bench. And I'd have my coffee and I would just warm up and play. Mm. And the people would, back before earphones.
Yep.
You know, back before everybody had earbuds and they carried cash.
Yeah.
So everybody carried cash. Nobody had earbuds. And, it was a free time.
Really was.
But, yeah, so I'd set up and I'd play from about, I'd start like actually playing songs around probably 6:30 until about 9:30.
Yeah.
And then I would get up, pack up my stuff, go back to my apartment, and then do whatever the heck I wanted to and probably hang out with friends. I don't know. Talk about feral. I was feral. And I would do that in the winter and the colder months, I would play the T stations. And then in the warmer months, Harvard Square was my main jam. Again, early in the morning, go get a spot, camp out, share it with something. Peter Mulvey and I used to, you know, I used to go get the spot and then he'd come in later. He showed me his busking gear and he, you know, directed me towards like what to get. And then once I had some money, I could buy that. So I bought the real stuff. And Yeah, Peter was a big, he kind of trained me.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
The busking mentor.
Yeah, he was my busking mentor. And then, you know, Brian and I started busking together. My friend Rod would come out. But I would be out there, like get a scone and a coffee at Au Bon Pain. And sit there and eat my orange iced scone.
Wow.
And drink my coffee and just, yeah. And I made a living that way.
So amazing.
Very great.
A lot of our friends did back then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Very cool.
All right. Now let's talk about the Pittsburgh years. You lived in Pittsburgh like mid 90s to the year 2000,
yep.
Which sounds like you floated into town in a very bohemian like fashion. Some artist friends lived there and you followed your bliss.
Yep.
Also, it must have been so cheap.
Yeah, it's incredible.
What was your scene like there, and why do you think Pittsburgh was such an important time for you?
Well, so my artist friends there were visual and theater, primarily.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know any musicians, except for actually Carl Mullen was one of my... Do you remember
Oh, yes.
Carl Mullen?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My boyfriend at the time, Jeffrey Carpenter, who is a big, now kind of a big deal in the theater world there, he had a pretty vigorous theater group. He knew Carl. And once I met Carl, I mean, I was playing everywhere. And Carl and I played together in like art installations, theater installations. We would do the music part, and there would be, very interactive theater. And then I started to play clubs, and then I got to know other musicians, the Vibro Kings. I'm in trouble if I don't remember some more, Rusted Root, some of the gang from Rusted Root, Liz.
Oh, Liz Berlin.
Liz Berlin and I would play together.
My gosh, she is the nicest person.
Isn't she just
alive?
I know. She's like a damn angel.
Also, shout out to Liz Berlin for her and her husband opening Mr. Smalls.
Oh, Mr. Smalls.
At a time when all the venues in Pittsburgh sucked.
Yep.
And she and her husband
and boy have
opened
they
it up.
Yeah, and it's doing well,
really well
now. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, I was there when Mr. Smalls was just starting.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, Mr. Smalls is a music venue in Pittsburgh. It's actually in Millvale, Pennsylvania,
yep.
which
yep.
is right across the river, and it is an old church that they transitioned into a music venue, and for a while it was like the only game in town.
Yeah.
And I, whenever I would bring people there, I'd be like, Rusted Root built this
place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
This is send me on my way money.
This is send me on my way money. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And they did.
Isn't it so exciting when every like 5 years that song gets used in like an enterprise commercial or some kind of insurance commercial? And you're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Cha-ching. You guys. Yeah. You get that.
You get it.
Get that those, commercial money.
Get those dollars. Yep. We, those guys were great. Crisis Car was Corel Tunador's band. Corel and I collaborated on some stuff. He played on a record of mine that I made there. Corel has been out in LA and he's been in the Goo Goo Dolls for the past, 20 years, their whole career.
Wow.
And he and I are still in touch. In fact, I need to get him this album. He knew it was coming out, but it's just, people get caught up in their stuff.
Sure.
I need to send him not a copy. There's no copy.
Send him a link.
A link.
Yeah, send him a link. Can you tell the opening for David Gray story, please?
Oh, This is the best story. Okay, so I was... Carl got me the gig opening for David Gray at a probably 500-seat theater
Is it Rosebud?
Club. Yeah. Rosebud. Was it Rosebud?
Or Metropole. Those are the two venues that people would talk about all the time. And the Sierra Mosque.
It was the Rosebud.
Rosebud.
Yeah, it was the Rosebud. Okay. So 500, you know, a lot of standing, not really a sitting. There was some sitting, a lot of standing. And I went in, and so I'm the opening act, and I'm, you know, I'm kind of just there to tune my guitar, sitting on a bench. And there's nobody there, of course. Yeah, a couple of people milling around, but I go in and I'm working on my guitar and this guy comes over. I don't know who David Gray is at this point.
There's no internet. You don't know what he looks like.
Yeah, I don't know what he looks like. I think I may have heard a couple of his songs Carl played for me. So I'm sitting there tuning my guitar and this guy comes up to me and he's kind of chatting a little and he's got what looks like a janitor's shirt on. And I remember I had just had like an argument with my boyfriend. Mm. So I was in that headspace of like way in my head, way like kind of fumey and mm-hmm. just, you know, that not great space. So I didn't want anyone to talk to me. I was like, and you know, he was like kind of flirty, like in a sweet way. You know, looking back on it now, he wanted to chat. He wanted to like say hi. And I was like stone cold.
Yep.
And then I did my set. And then afterwards, he came up to me and he was like, hey, I'm David. I'm going to play. That sounds great. You know, sounded great. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah. And so then he played and he became my favorite. And I've been kicking myself ever since. And he wrote on my, I got a poster and he wrote, keep strumming. And then in parentheses, corny remark.
Oh, which meant funny.
Yeah.
So funny.
Yeah. So that's my David Gray story. And then, but subsequently they came back and I went backstage and I said, hey, to them.
That's great.
Yeah. So it's all fine.
Yeah. So funny.
Our relationship is fine now.
Such a Rachel McCartney story. you recorded two albums in Pittsburgh. Throwing Rocks.
Oh my gosh.
In 96, mm-hmm. which I found a copy of at WYP and I feel like I took it with me. It's in my possession somewhere.
Okay.
And then Eye on the Horizon in 2000. So we talked about this a little bit at the beginning of the interview, but the cover of Eye on the Horizon is a photo of you and a horse, but it's up close. Mm-hmm. So it's like half your face, mm-hmm. half a horse's face.
Yep.
And so people have been saying, Rachel, that you are a bona fide horse girl.
Oh, yeah.
What do you say about these allegations?
Oh, they're absolutely true. Yeah, I've been a horse girl since I was small. I always wanted a horse. I got a horse. I've had several horses throughout my life at various times. I don't currently have a horse. I did have what we call our heart horse, and I had her for about 6 years, and she was my ride or die.
Mm.
And in that time, I was also kind of working with other people's horses, and then I worked with this mule, and we didn't have a great ride one time, and I fell off and broke my collarbone. Oh. And so I stopped doing other, you know, working with other people's horses, and just, you know, the bones get brittle, and I wasn't willing to take those risks anymore. But yeah, and it's funny now too, since I don't have my my Berra anymore, that desire, my horsey, it kind of like, I'm kind of all set with it. You know, I felt so safe on this horse, and I don't know that I would ever spend the time to develop a relationship like that with a horse that is necessary in order to, you know, ride safely.
That was the horse to end all horses.
Horse to end all horses.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I feel like I have a cat right now that ends all cats for me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There can't ever be a better one.
It's a funny, yeah, it's a funny thing, but I'm really at peace with that. And I'm still a horse girl, you know?
Yeah.
I still feel like.
Okay. So this is a little bit of a setup here. You moved back to Boston pre-9/11, like the year 2000,
yeah.
maybe.
Yeah.
I first saw you at Passim. I feel like it was the year 2000 for this like indie girl night.
Oh, okay.
And I was just like floored.
Amazing.
I got Eye on the Horizon, and then it became my new life of being like a lifelong Rachel McCartney devotee.
Amazing.
So in that time, like when you started busking with Peter Mulvey was your mentor, into the early 2000s and then up to a certain point, it was like such a fundamental time for that scene in Boston. Mm. The like singer-songwriter folk scene, and yep. a great place for it to happen because it had the infrastructure to support it.
Oh, yeah.
On like a local level, like
yeah.
newspapers
yes.
were very yep. supportive. There were many, like Boston Globe, The Weekly Dig, The Boston Phoenix, The Herald, you know, any of those newspapers were enthusiastic about supporting the scene. There were great radio stations that were actually playing and supporting these artists. And big audiences that would come out, you know, I mean, not like, you know, you couldn't sell at the Orpheum, but you could make a living and live in a town on that level. And
yep.
and I feel like for a lot of people that were in that scene, there were many hopeful moments for you and for a lot of our friends back then who like wanted to, quote, make it big
yep.
or like whatever,
yep.
whatever that means.
Yep.
So what can you say about that time in your career, like what your hopes were? What the coverage and the audience meant to your ambition and what it would feel like when your reality didn't match what you wanted to actually happen in your career.
Okay. Yeah. So I started the busking. What I loved about the busking is that it was very low pressure. Okay. I love to sing and play my guitar, and people happened to come by. There would be crowds that would form, and then they would enjoy. They would buy CDs, sign up at the mailing list, and then leave.
Yeah.
And it was just this beautiful flow of people. And that kind of built so naturally into me, you know, headlining at Passim or playing. Toad was another one that I would do well at. But all from my mailing list and all from, you know, little blurbs in the newspapers, as you were saying, you know, it was a very, brick and mortar time,
mm.
you know, there was no, I think MySpace started to happen in 2000 or something,
yeah,
you know, and then that was kind of something to get on. But other than that, it was emails, it was newspaper.
You're at Kinko's making show posters.
My goodness. Yes, exactly. And I had some supportive folks. My friend Nancy Darish, she was, she's been a marketer all her career life, and she, you know, would lend me some of her marketing pointers. Michelle Conceison, now of Market Monkeys,
and our Lord and Savior, Michelle Conceison.
Our Lord and Savior. She started Market Monkeys back with me and my mailing list, really, and her business degrees. And this all kind of was the germinating point. I think she would agree. Yes, she would agree. You agree, right, Michelle?
Yes. Let's call her.
Yeah.
Call her, you're on the line. Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be so cool.
Yeah. I need a couple extra cables in order
yeah.
to get that in.
Right. So, you know, then this became there came a time where it was like, yeah, you could go on tour and I would do little tours. And I'm telling you, I realized at a certain point, I'm not cut out for this anxiety. Mm. I'm not cut out for this ambiguity and this road life.
Mm.
Like, I want a home. I want to have kids. I want security. You know, I'm
mm-hmm.
a Taurus, like through and through.
Mm.
And so I really was quite anxiety written about the prospect of like going for it, mm-hmm. as they say. And I just settled in my heart that, you know, that wasn't what I wanted to do, as much as I did want it. So I was, you know, I was conflicted for a while because I did want it. I did want to perform for larger and larger crowds, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the sacrifice I saw that it would take down the road, I didn't feel like I needed it also. Mm-hmm. I think I lacked a certain drive for it. A lot of my, you know, success really has been kind of haphazard. I mean, the music is what it is and people like it for what it is. But the success has been, the grassroots level. And of course, to be even more successful, you have to have that drive and you have to have that motivation. And mm-hmm. I think I just, I couldn't come to terms with that.
Yeah.
Lifestyle.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Okay. At a certain point, you decided, as we talked about, career in music, it's not for you. And you wanted to start a family, build a career. First, you were an intensive care nurse, and then you became a labor and delivery nurse, which you are now.
Yes.
Yep. Where has music been for you, like, during these 17 years away?
Music has been something that I can kind of walk away from and do other stuff and kind of walk back to when I want to. I haven't been very, there was a long period of time where I wasn't very like, quote, disciplined about playing. I had little kids. You can imagine. I mean, my kids were 18 months apart. So once I had children and a career in nursing, I was busy, you know, I didn't feel a lot of creative drive. It's pretty much kids suck the life out of you in terms of any sort of internal life you might have.
Yeah.
It's really, but
now you're talking,
but you know, I really did. I had this, this visualization when my kids were babies, about music. I said, I'm putting you on the back burner and I'm just going to let you simmer there. Or maybe I'll turn the heat off and maybe sometimes I'll put it up to like a simmer. And I knew there would be a time when I came back to myself in that way. And all throughout that time, I was still writing songs. Like, I would pick up the guitar. And every time I pick up the guitar, even now, there's something that comes out. There's a song. There's a melody. It just depends on whether I'm in the place to follow that through, and create the song. More and more I am when I sit down and I have something come, I'm like, okay, this is what's happening now. Like, I'm not going to go to the gym. I'm going to write this song because it's happening now and I don't want to take it for granted. I think there was a lot of time in my early songwriting where I took it for granted. These songs would just come out, all finished, all done. Not much tweaking. Maybe they did need tweaking, but I didn't do much tweaking.
I wanted to ask about working in music and in healthcare. Mm. Have you seen any parallels?
Yeah. So the parallel for me between working in healthcare and music is my approach. So I learned the technical end of being a nurse, and that's very rigorous and very intense. However, I bring to my nursing a really heart-centered approach and a really love of humanity. I just love people. And so when somebody is in a compromised situation, I don't want them to feel like they're just a number or that I'm going through the motions. You know, mm-hmm. I see it as my job to really connect to this human and find a way, you know, for them to, you know, feel cared for energetically as well as with whatever medications or positions I'm putting them in to either have their baby or get over a, you know, some kind of illness, mm-hmm. just to feel that extra nurturing. So I think I'm a very nurturing person. Mm. So healthcare is really great, or has been really great for that aspect of my personality. And I think I come to music with that approach too. I'm not very intellectual about the music. I don't. It's just my approach isn't very intellectual. It's very kind of heart centered.
Yeah. And, but you can read music, which is
but I can read music. Yeah, that is interesting. you know, and I remember in the early days, a lot of people just really feeling that, you know, mm-hmm. getting that connection, and that was always very, I guess, validating, or it made me feel like it was worthwhile.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. I'd like to talk about your kids, Felix and Hazel. I know that having a family was always important to you. Mm-hmm. I remember when you were talking about stepping away from music and kind of like felt the biological clock mm-hmm. ticking.
Mm-hmm.
How has parenthood been different than what you expected it to be?
Well, it's interesting. I think when you start out having kids, there's just such a romantic, nobody can tell you about the journey.
Yeah.
They can tell you about the journey. Like I tell you one day, Francis is going to be running around here and you're going to be inside cooking or doing something else. And it's hard for you to imagine that day. You know, I wanted babies. And so I had the babies, and the toddler years were rough. I don't think I enjoyed them as much as some friends that I know. They yearn for those days.
Brian was talking about how those are his favorite years. And I'm like, what? When they first start talking and they don't know what they're saying.
Cute. It's tough. And I think a lot of parents do split the weight now. Of those early years. So the question was, how has my parenting evolved, basically, do you think?
How is it different than what you expected?
Yeah. I think I've gone into it with a pretty open mind, not really knowing what to expect. And I think for some reason, that's served my kids well, and it served me well. My kids are now teenagers, and this is my favorite. I think I've said that about a lot of the stages, though, all the stages. This is my favorite. But now that I have more of a context,
mm-hmm.
the teenagers, we talk about deep stuff. We talk about our feelings. They talk about their feelings. I'm their place that they go to. And I guess it's different because I didn't realize that they were going to be teaching me so much about myself.
Mm.
You know, you kind of think like, well, you're the parent, you're the boss. And there is a lot of that instinctually. Sometimes you want them to like, you know, don't talk and do what I say. You know, as they get older and a little bit more resistant,
mm-hmm.
There can be a power struggle. And I just learned that, like, I'm really learning so much about myself.
Yeah.
And it's a really nice place to be because it takes the pressure off of me feeling like, oh, I've really got to mold these kids. I've really got to, you know, and roots to wings, you know, we give them roots and then they can grow their wings.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as long as I keep remembering, you know, I give them the basics, you know, being a good human and caring and loving, they really do translate that into their own unique expression, which I didn't expect to be so incredibly unique and to learn so much from it.
your kids seem very grounded in their gender identities. Mm. You shared with me and you said it was okay to share. Felix is trans and Hazel is non-binary. How does their relationship to gender impact your own relationship to gender?
Huh, interesting. I think in a way that I've always been very kind of non-binary myself, mm-hmm. although we didn't have a language for that. I mean, I've always been a girl,
yep,
but not necessarily a girly girl. And I've been hanging with the bros for a long time.
Right, the dad band.
The dad band, being a musician, being around a lot of guys. Mm-hmm. And so I think maybe my fluidity in that has given them kind of a freedom to kind of go, hey, you know, mom's not really a lady. I mean, I can be a lady, you know, you can dress me up. But I think that their freedom of expression has really astounded me at how strong they are, and also how they're going to follow their internal guidance system, and they're not concerned with fitting in. And I really love that.
Yeah.
I love that so much. I still want to protect them, and I feel very protective at times. But I also trust there are so many good communities in place. And I think even in the tumult that is happening, I still believe in the goodness of people at large. Mm. I really do. And in the communities, the LGBTQ communities that are thriving. And I just know my kids are going to find those places where they're comfortable and safe.
Mm, that's great. During the pandemic, you reconnected with your friend and longtime collaborator, Teddy Goldstein. One Teddy Goldstein.
Mm-hmm.
And started writing again with Teddy.
Yep.
What did that reconnection mean to you and your creativity?
So this is a great time for my songwriting and Teddy's songwriting. So during COVID, how this started was Teddy's been a part of this Sunday song group. So he writes a song every Sunday, which I didn't understand. I tried it for a month or so, and I just, you know, I've got kids.
No, ma'am. Yeah.
Kids are small. Like, I, you know, the regularity of it was, I couldn't get it together. But that led us to throwing stuff back and forth on the phone. You know, I have this idea. I really need a bridge. He's great for bridge ideas. I've given him some bridges for his songs. And then, of course, I covered Fully, which I found I found that years ago, and I was obsessed with that song, obsessed to make it mine. Mm. And which I did. I always say about Fully, this is a song of mine that Teddy wrote. And, you know, Teddy's such a fan and a encourager and cheerleader of mine, like just so steadfast about his support, and not afraid to, you know, really kind of take the reins on one of my songs and say, you know, this needs to, like, let's really kind of take it in this direction. Let's see what if we do this. And and, you know, there's a lot of freedom in that too, because it opens my, you know, if I'm having tunnel vision about something, it helps to expand that. We've just had a great, I mean, years. How long ago was COVID? Like a long time ago.
5 years ago.
Five, 6 years ago. So,
Years ago.
And he and I, so we had been consistent about that. And then we just, by the end of, you know, four or five years, we had all these songs.
Yeah.
And I had always wanted to put them together in a recording. I didn't think that there was going to be this this big of a project, which without my friend Jeff would not have been possible.
Yeah. How do you see the subjects you're writing about differently versus like what you used to write about now that you're in this like new phase of your
musicality? I don't know, like shitty relationships. those are timeless. Those stay the same. No, I'm done with shitty relationships.
Amen.
Yes, I met a fine fellow and it just things are going swimmingly.
Your male partner.
My male partner. Yeah.
Shout out.
Yep. Shout out to my very masculine male partner.
Yes.
So what was the question again? So about
how do you see the subjects you're writing about differently now that you are in this new phase of your music life?
Everything's so much more esoteric for me. I mean, I live in an esoteric bubble, I feel like. I see through a lot of circumstances. I see through a lot of walls that people have. I kind of feel feelings of other people a lot.
Empathy.
Empathy.
Oh.
So
there's a word for that.
Yeah. I go through life very empathically. And if something is triggering me, I want to figure it out. And I think sometimes songwriting helps me to figure it out and to put a spin on it that is going to be useful for me and possibly others, because God damn it, life is too short to be dysregulated with all the triggers that happen on any given day.
So your new album, Taming Dragons, it's your first full-length release in 17 years, produced by the wonderful Zachariah Hickman,
woo-hoo!
Who got the band together, including Rose Polenzani, bestie on vocals. Rose was telling me when she went to the recording sessions, she just was so happy for you because you just seemed to be so joyful with everybody when you were recording the record. So can you talk about what that joy felt like or how it felt like to be in the studio with everyone making this record?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I had I felt just such gratitude. I mean, I couldn't believe I was in this situation. I was pinching myself. I feel like because I had envisioned something of a recording, something of a record. I didn't know. I thought maybe it would be in my friend's basement or, you know, at a studio down the road from me, which is a fine studio. But to have it be with Zach and his A team and Rose, I was just giddy and trying to act as professional and as I could, you know. And I was very focused. I was joyful, but I was focused when I went in there because we had 3 days to bust out the tracks, all the basic stuff. And boy, I was on a mission. So by the time Rose came in to do vocals, all that was done. And I was a lot more kind of in the exuberant space of, that's done.
Yeah.
And it went well. And I was so excited for her input. But yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that, Rose was able to be a part of that. I can't hear another voice on some of those harmonies.
Yeah.
It was perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you played some album release shows for Taming Dragons and, I saw the Passim show. So great. What's it been like to be back on stage with these new songs and these new collaborators?
Yeah. So, well, being on the stage with the band that recorded the album was, again, surreal. And I was quite nervous to be at Passim again. I don't know what it is about Passim. It just, those halls are they're rich, you know, and there's always a sense of rising to that bar. So to be back on stage at Passim was exhilarating. It was very soothing in a way as well. I felt very happy to get the songs out to a lot of people that I didn't know. I didn't see a lot of, you know, same faces, although there were a handful of fans that came up and had me sign one of my older CDs, you know, and I remembered them from coming to shows 20 years ago.
Any throwing rocks?
No, there was no...
No throwing rocks, no Ray.
No. Yeah, no, I didn't sign any of those.
Yeah.
But it's been great. And I'm working with Michelle still at getting, you know, other gigs, and who knows how... you know, I don't want to say motivated. I'm motivated, but you know, ambitious I'll get. But it does kind of feed on itself. You know, you have a nice gig, and it can be infectious. And I feel like at this stage of my life, I've got room for hobbies.
Yes, but do you feel like that? And when you say infectious, like, do you feel like it's like a dangerous that you could like sort of like spiral back into anxiety about things?
Yeah, no, because I'm so set and firm about what I need to be grounded and happy. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing about being older. And there are things that are just non-negotiable, you know?
Yeah, that's great to hear.
Yes, yes.
I feel that.
Yeah. So, I'll go on tour. I'll do stuff for 3 weeks at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to make it my life.
Yeah.
There's other things that I want to do.
Yeah.
And I don't have this. I mean, I'm in bed at 9 o'clock and up at 5 most days. So yeah. I don't know. To shift that into a musician's hours would be challenging for me.
We had a great interview with Mark Arelli and Joe Henry, and they are also early risers. And like, if I wake up early and something is happening like within our world, I know I can text Mark because he'll text right back.
Interesting.
If it's like pre-dawn. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I send Mark early morning folk music gossip questions and also pictures of bugs to ask him, what is this bug? Because he's a bug scientist.
Wow.
Too. Yeah.
Is he really a bug scientist?
Yes.
Like, he does science?
Entomology. Yeah. It's what he went to school for.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he...
Now you can text Mark pictures of bugs.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I can. And he won't be disturbed at the earliness. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. And there can be nights that you stay up late as a musician, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that I'll be able to have that capacity. But just in general, I like my home. And
All right. One more question and then we'll do the lightning round. Did you know Tori Amos, my other favorite?
Yes. I also knew that.
Released a Dragon Forward album this year? In Times of Dragons?
I did not know that.
Isn't that crazy?
You know what? Can we talk about the title of Taming Dragons?
Yes, please.
And what it means to me?
Yes.
Speaking of Tori Amos, and I just think dragons are the, you know, most mythical and kind of esoteric symbols. And for me, that... that imagery of taming dragons, right? It really kind of coming of age, coming to know my non-negotiables, coming to know myself in a way that, you know, learning how to regulate my nervous system. These are all these are all things that people are talking about now, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So we're all kind of talking about taming our dragons, you know, regulating our nervous systems and, you know, meditation. And everything springs forth from there, what we bring to our societies, mm-hmm. right? It mm-hmm. all starts with us. So that's where the imagery and the intention for the title of Taming Dragons came from.
I love that.
And I love the Tori Amos.
Yeah. And it's, I've not like liked any of her albums since like, you know, the early 2000s.
Okay.
And the fact that you both released Dragon albums this year, and I went and I saw her perform last week.
Ugh.
And I saw your show.
Ugh.
And like, just amazing.
Great.
Like, it's 2002 again. So good.
Great. And so you liked her
yes.
stuff? You were feeling good
yes.
about it? Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
It's great. It's a great album, and as
great.
Is yours.
Thank you. I'm going
to
check
I'm going
to
play them simultaneously to see if I can, if anything syncs up or I get any secret messages.
I'm right. going to be surprised.
All right. Here's the lightning round.
Ooh.
What is one song you wish you had written?
One song I wish I had written. Okay. There's a new song by Sophia Bianco, and it's called Punch.
That's it?
And it needs to be famous, and it needs to be on the charts.
All right. I don't know it. I'm going to check it out.
Yeah, check it out.
I will. Who do you want to play you in the movie of your life?
Who do I want to play me in the movie of my life? I want Scarlett Johansson.
Great. That would be great. Perfect. What is your ideal midnight snack? Not that you're ever up at midnight.
My ideal midnight snack is chocolate-covered almonds with pretzels and walnuts.
Nice. What are you listening to in the car? So this is a two-part question. What are you listening to in the car on a long drive? And what are you listening to in the car on a short drive?
I'm listening to Braka Braka. Right now they're a Ukrainian group. I just saw them in Portsmouth, and I became a huge fan.
Wow.
And I listened to them on the way up here. So that's a long drive, an
yeah.
hour.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then in short drives, I either usually don't listen to anything. I take that as a quiet time. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times I'll listen to a podcast of telepathy tapes. Are you talking about music, though? I should keep it to music.
No, no. Okay. Whatever you want to listen
telepathy
to.
Telepathy Tapes is a podcast that I've been listening to. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
Yes. That's right up my alley.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What is your biggest pet peeve?
My biggest pet peeve is when people talk negative self-talk.
Mm.
Negative self-talk.
Yeah.
I think. And we all do it. I do it.
Yeah.
But when somebody's doing it out loud in front of me, it feels really awkward. And
you should just hold your hand up and be like, you're really annoying me.
No.
Right now.
No, I just want to love them. I want to love them into self-love.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of a weird pet peeve. Okay. When people don't know how to merge.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's more
yeah.
what you're looking for.
I like the other one, too.
Okay.
Yeah. The other one is good.
Yeah.
All right. This is the last one. Where is the most beautiful place in the world?
I think the most beautiful place in the world is Stonehouse Pond in Barrington, New Hampshire. I've been going there and paddleboarding and swimming for the past couple of months. It's a spring-fed pond
wow.
/ quarry. And it's magical.
Okay, let's go.
Let's go.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
This has been awesome, Rachel. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy. This has been great.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can find us on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. Search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can check out BasicFolk.com or listen wherever you get your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, maybe you should share it with a friend. Perhaps that friend that you went to college with, that you have many memories of seeing Rachel McCartney concerts with, and then going back to her apartment in Central Square and spending the night on her hard as a rock futon, where you had to train yourself to lay on your back. Otherwise, you would be sleeping in the shape of a U. Send it to that friend. Okay, thanks for listening all the way to the end. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.